You know you've got a comeback in you. When you take the next step, you're going to make it count. For your career, for your family, for your life. You can earn a degree you're proud of with Purdue Global. Purdue Global is backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected and innovative public universities. This is your chance. This is your opportunity. This is your comeback. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
You don't just live in your home, you live in your neighborhood as well. So when you're shopping for a home, you want to know as much about the area around it as possible. Luckily, Homes.com has got you covered. Each listing features a comprehensive neighborhood guide from local experts. Everything you'd ever want to know about a neighborhood, including the number of homes for sale, transportation, local amenities, cultural attractions, unique qualities, and even things like median lot size and a noise score. Homes.com. We've done your homework.
Hey everyone, it's Ted from Consumer Cellular, the guy in the orange sweater, and this is your wake-up call. If you're paying too much for wireless service, you don't have to keep having that nightmare. Consumer Cellular has the same fast, reliable coverage as the leading carriers for less. And for a limited time, new customers receive their second month free when they sign up and use promo code MONTHFREE by May 31st. So why keep spending more than you have to? Seriously, wake up and call 1-888-FREEDOM or visit ConsumerCellular.com.
Taxes, fees, and other third-party charges will apply. See website for additional details.
You know that feeling when you walk into your home, take a deep breath, and feel new? Well, that's what it's like to use Clorox Scentiva. Because Clorox Scentiva smells like coconut, cleans like Clorox, and feels like energy. It'll elevate any cleaning routine to not just clean, but also make every room smell like a tropical coconut getaway. Discover how Clorox Scentiva's powerful clean and refreshing scents can transform your space. Get yours in coconut or other fabulous scents at a nearby retail store.
The Podcast Playground.
Hooray! I'm Buzz Knight, the host of Taking a Walk, Music History on Foot. Follow us at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And definitely share the podcast with a friend. Feel free to leave a review as well. We'd appreciate it. Today, we have the author of a recent book, You Can't Judge a Book by Its Cover. He is musician Ron Young, the founder of the band Little Caesar. He is an amazingly transparent storyteller about this era of hard rock and glam metal. He's had a wild ride, and he talks about it here on Taking a Walk. Well, Ron, thanks for being on Taking a Walk. It's really great to meet you, man.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
Describe that first moment that you talk about in the book, You Can't Judge a Book by Its Cover, that hooked you on music.
Oh, man. It was probably one of the first concerts I ever went to was Zeppelin. Song Remains the Same. I actually got to see one of those nights at Madison Square Garden. And just the power and this, it wasn't even, you know, because they didn't have pyro and huge lights. And, you know, it was like a bunch of guys set up 20 feet, you know. They didn't have any of that stuff that bands later became dependent on. And just the sheer power of the music and what it did to just tens of thousands of people. And it was totally intoxicating. And it just stuck with me that it must just be so cool to get to do that, you know, as your way of life, you know? So it just always stuck with me.
Well, then you had this other moment, too, that you talk about in the book. Let's just call it the hanky-panky moment. Can you talk about that?
Yes. Yes, that's also where I got to see the intoxication of this. I was like 6 years old, and I was living in this big apartment complex in Queens, New York, and they had this big pool party, and there was some just local cover band that was set up. Now, you know, the pools in New York City in these big you know, apartment complexes would have 1,000 people come there on a Saturday and just sit around the pool. And it was an Olympic-sized pool. And so this band is playing. And when they were taking a break, I was like, I would love to sing, you know. And they're like, you know, laugh, laugh, laugh. And they're like, what song do you know? And I was like, My Baby Does the Hanky Panky, which I had no idea at 6 years old was such a sexually charged song. And they thought it would be absolutely hysterical for a six-year-old to get up there and sing Hanky Panky. And I did, terribly, of course. It doesn't matter. Just hearing a six-year-old singing, you know, My Baby Does the Hanky Panky, you know. And it's like the irony was lost on me, but all these people were laughing and clapping and cheering, and it really got in under my skin.
You know, I was told, I was never a musician, but I'm, you know, got stuck on the music business and the radio business, got it in my blood. I don't remember this, but I was told in church at 2 years old, I sang this song by Fabian called Turn Me Loose, that I don't even remember that song.
And, right.
But apparently there I was in church singing it. So,
well, you see, it is intoxicating, I'm telling you.
So I was a Mets fan. I grew up in Stamford, Connecticut, and you were in that backyard of Shea Stadium. Should we sing a version of the Meets the Mets theme and see if we can really turn everybody off?
You know, I only remember like the first couple of lines, but yes, I was totally in the backyard. I was living in a place called Lefrak City, where literally you could walk over to the world, you know, where Shea Stadium was, which was over by the World's Fair Pavilion. And so I used to go to games all the time. And, you know, my brother would take me, or occasionally I'd go with my dad. And this is when the Mets were in the toilet. I mean, these guys were down in the basement, new team. You know, there was maybe 5,000, 4,000 people in the whole stadium, you know. And then over the years, over the next 4 or 5 years, they started to become the Miracle Mets, you know. But I knew all the players and you know, everything about them. And, you know, it was really a huge part of my childhood sort of, you know, entertainment was going to see Mets games.
And I think you describe in the book this amazing story about Banner Day at Shea Stadium. Yeah. And I think I might have been at that banner day because I went to a few banner days. Can you tell that story?
Yeah, it's 1966. And the Mets, you know, trying to get people out to the park, did this thing called Banner Day, where they invited all the fans down on the field to parade around with banners and compete. And, you know, they had like 3 or 4 prizes. And, you know, at this point, the grand prize was, we won, and the grand prize was a black and white Admiral black and white television, a case of tuna fish, you know, as we call it in New York, tuna fish, you know, canned tuna. And this was all they could afford, you know. Once they became world champions, you know, it's like a trip to Hawaii. You know, I think years later, they'd given away cars and stuff like that. No, we got a black and white TV. But begrudgingly, my brother brought me down there. He wanted to go. My mom made him take me to the game. And he came up with this, you know, clever little way of, you know, dressing us up at 6 years old. And next thing you know, we're getting pulled into the dugout by these famous ball players, Jerry Groder, Ron Svoboda, Tom Seaver, you know. So I got to meet all my heroes, and I had no idea, you know, what this was. And yeah, next thing you know, we're like, we made it into the yearbook, and, you know, they invited us on television because, you know, I guess it was quite the novel concept for a couple of 6 year olds to win Banner Day in New York, you know.
And you described, you know, that moment. And certainly, you know, the hanky-panky moment, your moment of fame with the New York Post and being on the cover with Mayor Lindsay. And
No, and I was on Candy Camera too. They came to my nursery school and they picked me and a few other kids to be on Candy Camera. So here I am, 6 years old. I've already been on the cover of a major, you know, U.S. newspaper. I've been on Candy Camera. I've been on a show called Wonderama, which is regional at the time. You know, so here I am, 6 years old. I've already had these brushes with fame and notoriety. And yeah, definitely very addictive, you know, no doubt about that. To get, you know, this is before social media, the internet, you know. So I think there's something in the human personality about having attention, you know, wanting to be on TikTok or on Twitter or, you know, and even back then, very much, you know, proving the point that people all want to be, have their 15 minutes of fame.
But it was this odd paradox going on in your life because you had this horrible home life that was going on. And you were, you know, cowering at many instances in that environment, but yet you had that addiction to entertaining people. It was a strange paradox.
Yeah, you know, psychologically, I don't, you know, I think it's, you know, when you grow up in a household with an alcoholic, you know, who is a drama queen and wants all the attention, you know, and all you're trying to do is stay below the radar because you don't want all the fallout that comes with that. And then you kind of get out into the world and there's these ways of getting the attention. You know, definitely something truly psychological going on in that whole sort of situation. Definitely a lot of relief and a lot of, sanctuary, so to speak.
And on this podcast, we talk frequently about the power of what music does for people in challenging times, whether it be physical, emotional, mental. Music really was a saving grace for you, wasn't it?
Oh, without a doubt. It was an escape mechanism. It was a fantasy mechanism. You know, being able to close my eyes. I mean, music takes you places, you know, and it paints these sonic pictures and it tells these sonic stories. And, you know, when you're young and impressionable and these things that move you to feel these emotions, it becomes incredibly powerful. And, you know, everybody has songs that have been woven into the fabric of their lives, you know. You could play a song from high school and you all of a sudden are taken back to the memories, you know? And so music has these sort of time markers in your life. And it's such a powerful psychological tool. And I think it's one of the things that makes music, you know, just incredibly powerful and vital to people's lives.
So the band Little Caesar, I would say the band Little Caesar is also this paradox of success and then this breakdown of the whole system, all in one. Why do you think it was so complicated?
It was complicated between, it was a combination of battles of enormous egos and just, you know, when everything that could possibly go wrong goes wrong in like a 1 month period in a business that doesn't have a lot of patience, you know, and then you combine adversity with a bunch of people who are trying to protect their success, you know, column, keep their batting average up, so to speak. You put all that together and it's the perfect storm for a meteoric rise and then a meteoric fall. And that's what happened to us, you know. Unfortunately, you know, for us guys in the band, it's you know, this is our life. We're not just a commodity. We weren't just a, you know, a name on a roster. So it was a really complicated whirlwind kind of thing that just kind of steamrolled us.
You know, the Geffen years, as I'm reading that, and I knew some of the characters from that period of time, and they were always very gracious to me. People like Marco Babineau, as an example. But that era, the way you describe it as I'm reading this, if it were a movie, it almost reminds me of part Mob, Goodfellas, part Three Stooges.
Oh, totally. Yeah. No, that's a great description. Yeah, you know, you have these larger-than-life characters like John Kalodner, like Marco Babineau, like David Geffen, like Jimmy Iovine, like Bob Rock, all involved in one project. And, you know, the little spats and the battles of the egos and, you know, these are guys that they considered themselves rock stars in their own realm in what they did. And they had professional rivalries and they had little power struggles. And when you put them all involved in one project, more likely than not, you're going to get turmoil more than you're going to get alignment. And that's exactly what wound up happening.
And they liked to get into to arguments with each other.
Oh, God, they lived for it. I mean, you know, Jimmy Iovine would love to get into it with David Geffen. You know, John Kalodner would love to get into it with you know, Eddie Rosenblatt and Marco Babineau and all of these guys. You know, they got to be where they are because they have these enormous personalities, egos as big as any rock star. The classic example is John Kalodner, who on every record puts his name twice. John Kalodner, John Kalodner. That was his hook, you know, to brand himself, who walks around in this white linen suit with his long brownish hair and John Lennon glasses, like he's some sort of spiritual sonic guru. And, you know, he's got this weird kind of voice, you know. And meanwhile, it's like we go into his office and I brought him, I remember when I brought him a shirt, our first Little Caesar shirt. And I go in and I give him the shirt. And I'm like, here's our first shirt. He goes, oh, wait, hold on a second. Let me return the favor. And he opens up his closet and he's got four of his own t-shirt designs. He's got his own merch, right? I mean, and it's four times as large as our selection of merch. And I just, it dawned on me that these guys are they're as much characters as any bandits, you know.
And then you talk about the amazing Gene Simmons and what you learned from being around that character. What did you learn from Mr. Simmons?
Oh, so many things. I mean, Gene is one of those guys that everybody has a love-hate relationship. You know, he's very outspoken. He's very opinionated. He's very caustic. He's very confrontational. He's also inside a sweet guy. There's a nice father and husband, and he tries to be helpful to people. But on the other side of the coin, he will turn around and snuff you like a candle just because it suits his ego, you know? And so to be around a character like that and to watch him, I mean, literally every day on tour, he's holding court. He had a couch that the crew would bring out and put into the middle, like we were doing a lot of outdoor sheds, so outdoor venues. So they would bring this sort of leatherette couch out into the middle of catering, and he'd come and hold court like he was the Queen of Sheba or Jabba the Hutt, depending on the way you saw him, you know. And he would just sit there and comment on women, how they were dressed, what they looked like, what guys were doing, what guys were saying. He'd call people over, have them sit down next to him. It was astounding to watch. And this is how he entertained himself.
It's almost surreal.
Oh, it totally was. I mean, because we were like, look at this guy. He you couldn't have written a character in a movie any deeper than this guy was. And yet on the other side of the coin, he used to come backstage every night after our set. And he would give us like a coach at halftime. He'd come back and he'd critique, okay, tonight this song was a little too fast. You guys are moving around on stage too much. Slow down. You know, you have to be more exaggerated in your movements. Wear different clothing. He was vicious in his commentary. You know, he pulled no punches. But the reality is that 80, 90% of the time, he was right on the money. I mean, this is a guy that is... He's been doing arena shows. You know, this is like our 10th show on tour. And this guy has done this thing like 400, 500, 600 times. So how could you not take his input as being gospel, you know? So on one hand, he used to drive us crazy because there were some things that we really disagreed about. And then on the other hand, we were really grateful that he was taking the time to coach us the way he was, you know?
And come on, a genius of merchandising. I mean, the Kiss coffin, right?
Oh, no, this guy invented it. I mean, seriously, I mean, the Beatles did merch, but Gene took it to a level that, you know, was unsurpassed. I mean, I don't think there's one thing on this planet that hasn't been made once with the Kiss logo on it and sold. Like you say, a coffin. There's probably Kiss toilets, you know. I mean, it's absolutely incredible the amount of things that they stuck the Kiss logo on and sold.
And you had this other surreal moment that was almost like an example of a Wharton School of Business moment with Big Al from the Salem Hells Angels in Salem, Massachusetts. Speaking to Steven Tyler from Aerosmith about a little situation. Can you tell a little bit of that story?
Yeah, we did a show for the Hells Angels up in Boston, and we got thrown out of our hotel because we were misbehaving. It was us and Junkyard. We were playing together up there. And we got thrown out of the hotel, so Al's like, okay, come stay at my house. So I'm staying at Al's house. Now, Big Al is the president of the Salem chapter of the Hells Angels. And I am not very comfortable, you know, because here I am, you know, with this rather large man with all of these sort of unscrupulous characters coming in and out of the house. And Al gets a phone call while I'm there about a problem that they're having, that Aerosmith came out with a new T-shirt design for their next tour that looked very, suspiciously similar to the Hells Angels logo. The red and white letters, the lettering that they used for Aerosmith in Boston, Massachusetts, in Rockers. And I was like, you know, so listening to Al get all of this information from some of the other members, you know, he's doing his due diligence, so to speak. And he's making notes on a notepad. And then he's like, okay, I got one more phone call to make. And he dials the phone and he's like, Steven, yeah, Big Al. Yeah, I'm good. Yeah, okay. So listen, word has it is that you've got a new T-shirt design that looks just like our logo. And he's like, make as many excuses as you want, but let me tell you, that logo is trademarked. The colors, the red and white, and that. Like, he lists this whole long thing like he's a lawyer in court. Not, when I see you, I'm going to break your face, or you guys are going to, you know, you're going to fall off the pier. No threats whatsoever. Purely methodical legal jargon, like he was some seasoned attorney, with threats of injunctions, threats of trademark infringement. And he hangs up the phone. He's like, okay, well, got that taken care of. There's going to be a whole warehouse of t-shirts that will never see the light of day. And I was completely blown away by the masterful, not emotional, no threats whatsoever, other than using the tools of the legal system, which had been used against gentlemen like this a million times, who has now turned the tables and who has gotten on the phone with someone who knows a thing or two about the music business and completely decimated him on a legal standpoint to do a verbal cease and desist. And it was beautiful. It was beautiful to watch and listen to.
Oh, I love it. So you had an almost moment involving the Red Hot Chili Peppers as well. And it was this moment in time where Flea was in some harm's way in terms of what he was doing.
No, actually, it was Anthony that was in harm's way.
Okay, sorry.
Yes. Anthony, this is 1986. I'm living in Los Angeles. The Chili Peppers were just, you know, they were just a local band that was signed to a record deal. I think this is the coming up on the Uplift Mofo Party Plan record, which is the record that really made him explode. And the band had gotten really tired of Anthony's antics, his drug antics. And he was a mess at the time. And, you know, at the time, Hillel was also in the band. He subsequently wound up overdosing and dying from heroin. But anyway, they kicked Anthony out of the band. And just they had figured that there was no way Anthony was going to get himself together. He tried a million times. So I went in and we started to work together and write songs together and rehearse together. We did demos of the whole record of everything that I wrote, because I had written a whole set of melodies and lyrics for all of those songs. And we demoed them all. And then the next thing I know, I get a phone call from Flea saying that Anthony was out of rehab and he was doing great. And, you know, that he was coming back into the band. It was great because the way he put it was, this is not about business. This is about family. You know, me and Anthony are family. We grew up together. We've had each other's back. He didn't need to explain any further to me. I totally understood it and I totally respected it. You know, he totally did the right thing. And then obviously years later, the band has evolved and Anthony's singing has evolved and his performances have evolved. And it was just, that band without Anthony just wouldn't be as successful or who they are, you know. So, but yeah, one of those almost famous moments, you know.
So I read the book and I think about the fact of so many trials, tribulations, great moments, lousy moments, and so many learnings. So in closing and thinking about that for maybe a musician that is, you know, challenged, trying to work their way up, that's listening to this podcast, what are some lessons that you would pass on that, you know, you learned the hard way?
Well, always be true to yourself and to your music. If you really believe in something, stick to your guns. Don't let some attorney or manager or record company guy or any of those people steer you off of your path musically. The reality is that any of these people that come to you to try to do business with you were attracted to you because of your music. Never let them forget that. Now, there's always other things from a business side or a marketing side, all those things you can be flexible in, but you gotta be true to yourself musically. Because first of all, that's the only way you're going to like who looks back in the mirror every morning, because you stay true to your art and to who you are. And just stay persistent, stay, you know, creative, stay prolific. Don't keep reworking the same song ideas over and over and over again. Just keep writing songs. Keep trying to play with as many people that you can, because each person that you play with will teach you something. You'll learn something from them, sometimes in a good way, sometimes in a bad way. Sometimes you'll, you know, sometimes you learn what you don't want to be, which is can be as helpful as knowing what you do want to be. Never equate commercial success with talent. There's a lot of really untalented people that become really famous and rich, and there's some incredibly talented players that you've never heard of. So one thing has nothing to do with the other.
Great advice, and a great book, a great read. You can't judge a book by its cover. Transparency about everything, and must have been therapeutic for you.
Oh, it was, totally.
Yeah.
But it's sort of like drinking too much and throwing up, you know? It's very therapeutic.
Thanks, Ron, for being on Taking a Walk.
My pleasure, Buzz. Thank you so much.
Taking a Walk with Buzz Knight is available on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
With every CBD product claiming to do something different, it's nearly impossible to decide what's best for you. Lazarus Naturals pioneered the farm-to-front-door model of transparency, where they handle each step of the production process to ensure quality, potency, and consistency. Scannable labels allow you to see the test results of your hemp batch so you can be confident in the safety and quality. Visit LazarusNaturals.com today. Lazarus Naturals, committed to improving your life as well as the world around you. Not available in Idaho, Iowa, or South Dakota.
Right here, right now. Find your beautiful new floor at Right Rug Flooring. Choose from thousands of in-stock styles, ready for next day installation, and all backed by the right price guarantee. Visit rightrug.com. That's RITERUG.com today to schedule a free in-home estimate or to find a location near you. 24-month financing is available with approved credit. For 90 years, we've been right here, right now. Right Rug Flooring.
Whether you're a savvy spender maximizing your savings with cashback rewards, a thrifty rate watcher seeking the lowest interest, or a travel enthusiast looking for extraordinary perks, Kemba Financial Credit Union has a Visa to complement your lifestyle and unique needs. Apply today at Kemba.org to unlock a limited-time 2% cashback on purchases and pay 0% interest on balance transfers for an entire year with a new Visa from Kemba. You deserve a card that works for you. Restrictions apply. Offer ends June 30th, 2024.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.